All right, I'd like to officially call the meeting for the Health and Human Services Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 18th, 2015? Representative McDonald moves the minutes for February 18th, 2005. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor for approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The minutes are approved. We have a couple of bills up today. Our first bill is House File 818. Is that the one you'd like to take first, Representative Zerwas? All right. Representative Zerwas would like to move the bill. Is that your case? Move her up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 818 to be laid over for possible inclusion in your bill.
Representative Zerwas moves that House File 818 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. We have the bill before the committee. We also have several testifiers who would like to speak to the bill. Why don't we have you introduce the bill, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 818 is the finance component for the Minnesota Stroke System bill. We heard the policy portion in policy a few weeks ago. This has been, for the last several years, as the stroke system was developed, this has historically been a part of the governor's budget. However, this year was left out of his budget as the stroke system is getting legs and getting up and running and getting ready to be implemented. Of course, what we spoke about in policy was the importance of having a comprehensive soup to nuts, as it were, system in order to treat critical stroke incidences. And so the key is that no matter where you are in the state of Minnesota, where you become a patient of a sudden onset stroke event, that you have the same set of protocols and systems in going forward. And what the stroke system does for monitoring strokes across Minnesota is to put in place this statewide system and coordinate care across the state. And so we have a few testifiers that can explain how far the system's been developed and what implementation will look like.
Welcome to the committees. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Justin Bell, and I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association. And just a little bit of background about the Minnesota stroke system. Stroke is a medical condition that's considered a time-critical condition, and that means that the biggest factor in determining patient outcomes is how quickly you get that patient to the appropriate treatment. And with most strokes that are blood clotting strokes or ischemic strokes, there's a window of time in which you can get a certain kind of treatment, thrombolytic, blood clot-busting treatment. And inside of that window of time, you have a very good chance of surviving and walking away from that acute event. And outside of that window of time, outcomes certainly plummet. So time matters. Minutes can be the difference between going home after your stroke or being going to a long-term care facility, going back to work, or being disabled. Minutes can be the difference between life and death. So the national consensus with these conditions is that we take a comprehensive systems-based approach to try to coordinate all the pieces of care to speed up how quickly we get that person to the care. The Minnesota Stroke System is a statewide network of ambulance services and acute care hospitals that meet national standard for treatments for acute stroke. And we developed a Minnesota-specific system over the past 5 years, utilizing input from stakeholders from all across the state. The stroke system has a bit higher implication for rural Minnesota. Roughly one-third of all strokes in Minnesota happen in rural outstate areas. And the system ensures that the quality of that acute care is even no matter where you have your stroke across the state. In 2014, we started designating hospitals as acute stroke capable. And we started out with those designated hospitals were all basically in the metro and larger cities. And we knew that if we really wanted to speed this up, we had to utilize our partners' smaller rural hospitals. So now we have 67 designated hospitals from across the state. As we pull together the different pieces of the stroke system, the Department of Health has played a coordinating role. And some of the things that they do is providing technical assistance to help hospitals meet those stroke-ready designation criteria, providing tools and resources to hospitals and ambulance services to help develop their programs and protocols, developing the online tool used for submitting applications, coordinating the review of designation applications by an external review committee, facilitating statewide advisory committees which monitor the system, and of course the registry program which collects the data and does analysis. The purpose for this bill is, up to this point, this system has been designed and implemented using money from a federal CDC grant for the Coverdell Stroke Registry. And that grant may or may not continue into the future, but it's very likely that even if it does continue, the parameters are going to be narrowed so that it really focuses on just the data collection and analysis and not these actual on-the-ground rolling out the system pieces. So Minnesota's used this federal money very wisely and efficiently to design and implement the system, but now it's time to sustain the system going forward, and that's what the appropriation is for. And I'd like to turn it over to Joan Soames, who's an emergency care nurse and has been a key component in working at the system in Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Soames. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Joni Soames, and I'm a registered nurse. I also worked in the emergency room for 40 years, right down the hill from where we're seated right now. My other hat is I also work as a pre-hospital provider, as a paramedic, and I teach pre-hospital people as well as teach nurses. And one of the things that I can tell you is that as a nurse, the stroke system has really helped it make it a lot easier for myself to take care of our patients, simply because I know time is brain. And if I can get that patient earlier, I can treat them faster. The faster I can get the medication, the better off it is. So I need training for the nurses. I also need training for my pre-hospital people who can recognize those stroke victims and get them to the hospital sooner. One of my jobs is to go out into the rural community and help with that teaching. And the system that Justin just got done explaining, all of the parameters, really help to make better care for all of our patients, as well as actually all of your constituents, because if they can't get out there and vote because they've had a stroke, you don't get any voting. So I would support, sorry, that's the way it is. I would support this simply because we need to have the funding in order to keep our stroke care in this state as high as possible. I can tell you, as a member of the National Emergency Nurses Association, it really gives me goosebumps when I can go out and explain our system to other people in other states, because they're saying, you guys are awesome and we want to implement what you're doing as well.
Thank you, Ms. Soames. And I have a Brian McDonaghy as the last testifier. No? All right. Representative Zerwas.
All right. If there aren't any questions, I think, members, I know this is going to be laid over, and it's possible to be included in your bill, Mr. Chair. And I think the reality is I've been very fortunate in my life. I had my stroke when I was 17. I was in Elk River. I was sitting on the couch in front of my dad, and suddenly I couldn't answer any questions. And when I fell forward and couldn't move anything on the right side of my body, he knew. He knew that I was probably suffering a stroke. And within moments, 911 was called. They did the assessment. They knew where to bring me immediately down to Abbott Northwestern Hospital for that interventional care, and we were very fortunate. And last January, I was driving in Elk River. It was a month before session was going to start again, and all of a sudden I got a terrible pain in my head and double vision. And I knew something was wrong, and I was driving right by my general practice clinic, and I walked in, and by the time I got in, I knew something was really wrong. And they were able to evaluate immediately and call and get our paramedics there. And Chair Dean was the one that met me, actually, in the emergency room that day when they did the TPA treatment to bust up that clot and treat that stroke. So this is very important. And as we look at this treatment, we're very fortunate in the amount of time that we spend in the metro area so close to our major medical centers with such a high quality of care. This funding and this bill ensures that quality of care and that system of treatment continues throughout the entire state, so that everybody in Minnesota gets that type of coordinated care and has that type of chance for recovery.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas, for the wrap-up. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Seeing no other testifiers, I would go to Representative Schumacher for the first question. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if we could get some background on what the Minnesota State Stroke System has done up to this point.
I think we could request that information. I don't know if anyone is here in the audience who can testify specifically to that, but I think the I see someone coming down now. Please identify yourself for the record, and if you can address Representative Schumacher's question, that would be great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Albert Tsai. I'm the director of the stroke program at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I've been running this stroke program since its inception. And I guess to answer your question, since in 2013, when the legislation to authorize the Department of Health to designate hospitals, we have been working hard to designate hospitals as acute stroke ready facilities. So to date, as Justin mentioned, that we've designated 67 hospitals in the state who are stroke ready. Is there any follow-up questions I'd be happy to take?
Thank you for that, Doctor. And could you talk about is there a designation, a stroke center for excellence, and does that have any kind of meaning outside of how do you get that designation, and are there specific centers within Minnesota that have maybe a higher level or those kinds of designations?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are nationally recognized three levels of stroke care. The highest level of care is what we call comprehensive stroke centers, and these are tertiary care centers that provide interventional procedures for advanced strokes, very advanced strokes. The second level is primary stroke center certification, and these are much of the large facilities as well that provide higher level of care, but not quite as high as comprehensive. And then the third level of care is what we call acute stroke ready or acute stroke capable facilities. And that's the level of care that we are focused on for rural Minnesota hospitals. These designations and certifications are nationally recognized by the Brain Attack Coalition, which is a coalition of stakeholder organizations concerned with heart disease and stroke from across the country.
And Doctor, just to follow up on that a little bit, in terms of intervention, the two things in diagnosis, the two things that I know about would be an MRI and some sort of surgical intervention. And what are the other things within that range, and how do they fall out along that continuum?
Mr. Chair, representatives, the first line of therapy for acute stroke ready hospitals and primary stroke centers is what we call the clot busting treatment, otherwise known as thrombolytic therapy, and that's for about 75% to 80% of strokes, for ischemic strokes. The other 15% to 20% of strokes are what we call hemorrhages or bleeds, and some of these require surgical intervention, and other types of advanced care that are not typically available at critical access hospitals, but at larger these comprehensive facilities.
Thank you, Doctor. Any other questions? Anything else from Representative Zerwas? Seeing none, Representative Zerwas, seeing none, we will hold this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And you have one additional bill, is that correct? The testifiers are free to move on there. We have House File 973, and would you like to move your bill, Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll move House File 973.
Representative Zerwas moves that House File 973 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS omnibus bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Yes, and then kind of while we have some testifiers for this bill, I'll kick it off, Mr. Chair, members. Minnesota's homestead plan requires that individual lives, that individuals live and work in the most integrated settings possible. And we as legislators can't do this alone. In fact, our state agencies can't do this alone. The homestead plan can be accomplished in Minnesota, but we must access and encourage the creativity, innovation of people with disabilities and those providing disability services. The Altair Accountability Care Organization is a collaboration of disability service providers that have been working together for the past 2 years towards the goals of implementing the Olmsted decision. Altair is a collaboration of 6 home and community-based service providers. We have Hammer Residents, LifeWork Services, Living Well Disability Services, Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota, Mount Olivet Rolling Acres, and Opportunities Partners. Together, this collaborative supports 6,600 people with disabilities on waivered services within Minnesota. Altair has been collaborating with DHS on innovative strategies to incentivize service providers to move more people with disabilities into the community and into a more independent lifestyle. And we've been working to reduce the waiting list and accomplish the goals of the Olmsted decision. Altair proposes a demonstration pilot that will incentivize service providers to support individuals to meet certain benchmarks around independent living and working, and require that they that those investments have incentives that measure performance. And we're confident that these savings will be demonstrated and that those savings can then be reinvested back into the program, helping grow the program. The reality is, members, there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution for Minnesota to implement Olmsted and reach those goals. There are many mechanisms that we need to access. We should look at reforming medical assistant asset limits, spend down the ABLE Act, expanding state quality counsel, and many more options. There is no silver bullet, but we must give opportunity to explore approaches that would have significant impacts and increase quality of life within the community. We have several testifiers joining me today from the partners within the cooperation, and I'll now let my testifiers discuss the pilot program and the work that they've been doing for the last 2 years with DHS.
Thanks, Representative Zeroas. Representative Liebling has a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, I think that from Representative Zerwas's description, I think it should be evident to all the members of this committee that this is really a policy bill. I mean, obviously it has a financial component, but it's got a lot of big policy questions in it. We're talking about a new model of dealing with people with disabilities, and so I would like to move that this bill, rather than be just simply laid over for the omnibus finance bill, that it be sent first to the Health and Human Service Reform Committee, where the policy can be more fully discussed. And I've been kind of watching Representative Hamilton kind of have a puzzled look, and maybe I'm misinterpreting, but you know, I just wonder if some of you might also be kind of wanting to explore more of the policy implications of this bill and not just have it be a matter of are we going to spend the money on this or not. So that would be my motion, Mr. Chair, would be to send this at the conclusion of the hearing here, to send it to the Policy Committee.
All right, Representative Liebling moves that the bill be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. Do you have comments to that, Representative Zerwas?
In speaking with the committee administrator and to the chairs of both committees, my understanding was that as a line item appropriation, that wasn't necessary. Mr. Chair, I'll leave it to the discretion of the chair of the committee, and we have no problem in doing whatever you'd like us to do.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Representative Mack is not currently at the committee hearing, and seeing as she's not here to to respond to that. I guess I'd be inclined to refer it back and leave that to the discretion of Representative Mack. So if that would be the case, then we could just move forward and move it that way. Why don't you proceed with your testimony, Representative Zervos?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we'll allow the testifiers to testify to the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Judy Lisney. I'm President and CEO of LifeWork Services and part of the Altair Accountable Care organization. I'm here this afternoon in support of House File 973. This proposal requests funds for a pilot for a pay-for-performance type model that would incent providers who achieve the goals of Olmstead of the Olmstead plan. This is one concept for scaling up and moving up the number of individuals who are moving into less restrictive service options. I know the governor's budget has a very similar proposal for a competitive RFP called the HCBS Innovation Pool. We are in support of that approach as well. We have a good working relationship with DHS, and we have involved numerous stakeholders in this concept. Under the current system, providers are compensated for delivering residential and employment services, mostly on a face-to-face basis. This proposal would pilot a pay-for-performance model for 200 individuals. It will provide an incentive for incurring those upfront costs of supporting individuals to move to a less expensive, more self-directed option. If successful, it will free up currently committed waiver funding to be used to reduce the waiting list. Our organizations are committed to the ideals of Olmstead. This proposal has been designed to increase the chances that people with disabilities will get to live and work in desegregated settings and in alignment with their skills and their capabilities. Our plan provides a coordinated approach to breaking down the barriers between employment, housing, and transportation so that we can scale up and speed up the progress that our organizations have made to date. We also hope to provide a model that others could follow. In the future state, based on what I understand from Medicaid Reform 2020, the county social worker or a consultative service provider will create a person-centered plan. If the person-centered plan indicates that the person needs employment services or less restrictive housing, the individual is then referred to an appropriate provider. That's where we come in. For individuals that are seeking to transition to a less restrictive service that we're already serving them, we'll use this implementation tool that we've developed and we're calling the Life Plan. And I'm sorry that it's so similar to the person-centered plan, but the person-centered plan is what's coming from the county and from the consultative services, and it is required by Olmstead. Our Life Plan, the purpose of that is to formalize the collaboration among providers and ensure success because we're coordinating. It also has a metric component to it so that we can better understand which strategies are leading to success and which ones don't seem to be as effective. The Life Plan is under development currently, and we will make it available to other providers if it proves to be successful at the end of this pilot. Once the case manager refers an individual to one of our organizations, or when the person-centered plan changes for someone we're serving currently, and they're wanting to move into a less restrictive setting, we'll use the Life Plan to assess the urgency of employment, housing, and health issues. So for example, if the person's housing is not in crisis, we like to move to employment first, because if you have a job first, you've got more options in terms of housing because you've got a different income to work with. And then we can address the housing options second so that they're living closer to and have transportation options for being able to get to work. At LifeWorks, there's certainly been times where we have placed people in jobs only to find out, oh, they're moving to another part of town and they can't actually get there. If the housing is in crisis, then, of course, we'd start with housing. But if we're working in collaboration, we could talk about what would be some good areas in terms of potential jobs for this individual and some transportation options, or what's the transportation like. So in summary, the life plan is an implementation plan, and it has metrics attached so we can see if we're producing results. This strategic approach will result in people with disabilities living more self-directed lives as envisioned in the Olmsted Plan. Lower costs for existing waiver recipients achieved through employment, less restrictive housing, and transportation can be redirected to people currently on the waiver. For 30 years, LifeWorks has been helping individuals lead more independent and satisfying lives through supported community employment. Last year, LifeWorks proudly supported 783 people to work as either contract workers or direct hires in about 260 Twin Cities and Mankato businesses. And they earned over $4.2 million for themselves. Many individuals begin with a job title, career training, full-time job coach through our day training and habilitation service. We work to help them build resumes and achieve a career path. As they become more independent, we move them to less expensive supported employment-based options. There's some success stories in your handouts. I also would like to introduce you to Scott Strowman. We're going to share his story with you today. Scott has been with LifeWorks for 14 years. Would you like to say where you're hired?
At Securia.
Hired at Securia downtown here,
yep,
directly.
Securia downtown directly.
Yeah, you've been working there about?
Almost 14 years.
And originally you were from Washington County, right?
Yep.
How did you get to your job when you started?
When I first got to my job, I used the city bus.
How did that work?
It worked, but, you know, we didn't have a lot to do when you live in the suburbs, you don't drive.
Yeah, so you had a job. Then where did you move?
Moved to downtown St. Paul, and I lived in one apartment that got too expensive, so I moved to another apartment, which made it so it was cheaper with subsidized housing.
And then how do you get to work now?
Skyway.
Skyway. We love downtown. And you get a little bit of help in your house from your family.
Yep.
And then
from a support service.
Supported living provider.
Supported living provider, too.
And so if you had gone into a day service, it would be costing the waiver about $23,000 a year. Right now, you have job coach support.
Mm-hmm.
What does your job coach support you with?
She helps me with my job, you know, if I have any issues personally or professionally, and she's there for me anytime I need her on anything. Helps me out on anything.
Because you've had some big changes while you've been there, right?
Oh,
things,
yeah.
Change. Can,
yeah,
you think of one?
Well, we have people that move and stuff from floors. You know, I deliver mail and stuff, so people change their positions and stuff, and then I got to change, you know. I deliver mail to different floors, but I take out the people's names, you know, and bring them down, you know, if they move to a different floor and stuff like that.
So the job coach is on call both for Scott and for the business if there's things that he needs a little extra training or a little extra time with. When he started, I think you delivered the mail. You picked it up in the mailroom with a card.
Yep.
And then they put trains in and delivered the mail with trains. So that was a pretty big change.
Well, actually, I came after the train system was put in.
So I'm telling somebody else's story.
Yeah.
The LifeWorks job coach is there to train for new tasks, help him get accommodations he might need. We're on call. Sometimes it's transportation. Sometimes it's even, you know, home or things change that we provide support with. But $23,000 versus $6,200 is a pretty big difference. Is there anything else you'd like the committee to know, Scott?
I really enjoy the services that's given to me, you know, from LifeWorks for job coaches and stuff. It really makes a difference. Helps keep me independent and everything too.
And before you came to LifeWorks, you were working, you found a job on your own, right?
Yeah, I was at Perkins. Was there 6.5 years washing dishes.
Yeah, so an office job's kind of a cool career.
Oh yeah.
Move.
Thank you, Mr. Strowman, for your testimony. Thank you for coming to the committee today. Thank you, Ms. Lisney. Next up, we have Julie Manwaren. Welcome. welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the testimony and proceed.
Chairman Dean and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here this afternoon to talk with you. My name is Julie Mann Warren, and I am the president and CEO of Living Well Disability Services, a nonprofit organization that delivers exceptional services that transform the lives of people impacted by disabilities. We provide support to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in our 33 group homes that are located throughout the 9-county metro area, as well as in their own homes, also in the metro area. We're proud to be a member of the Altair ACO. I'm here today to urge your full support for House File 973, a bill that supports a model with for people with disabilities to achieve community living and employment opportunities. The Olmstead and Jensen lawsuits, which I'm sure you've heard quite a lot about, requires plans to serve people in their most independent setting. While the need for group homes will continue to support people with the most intensive physical and behavioral needs, services in general are being redesigned to serve people in the most independent setting possible. The Life Plan, developed through the Altair ACO, helps to map how to make this a reality, person by person. The Life Plan is a tool that helps people both plan and prioritize resources in order to achieve their goals. It is an assessment that incorporates current needs, future desires, and it is done outside the annual formal planning meeting. You may know that people with developmental disabilities have an annual planning meeting, so this is done outside of that planning meeting. It can be conducted in the most comfortable, conversational manner by people who are most familiar with the person that they're supporting. It is revisited on an ongoing basis rather than once a year. How are you doing, Patsy? Good. The information rolls up into a person-centered, easy-to-read, one-page dashboard, and you have a copy, I believe, of that in your packet. That visually demonstrates what the person feels are the most important issues that they want to address. These priorities then serve as the basis for the whole team's efforts. Housing works to make sure that employment is a success. Employment works with housing to make sure that housing is successful. The domains are all important, but some issues need to drive the others depending on the desires of the person, and that may change over time. So I'm honored today to have Patsy Johnson here with me. Patsy lives with her husband and seven other people at her home in Robbinsdale. It's one of our intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities, also known as an ICFDD facility. It's an apartment building that was built in the 1960s, and it was licensed as an ICFDD, a group home, if you will, since the early 1980s. An ICF for people with developmental disabilities is licensed, it's duly licensed by both the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. And it requires that 24/7 supports are provided. So, Patsy, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and we have about a minute or so to answer, okay?
Okay.
So, how long have you lived at 3801?
I don't remember. I forgot. There's my advocate right there. She knows that part, and I don't know about that part.
It's been quite a long time, though, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
More than 10 years?
Probably 40 years, maybe.
How many? 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
So do you mind telling us a little bit about Mike?
Well,
is Mike your husband?
Yes, he is.
Mm-hmm.
But he's working today. I'm just in good spirit today. I like to come here. because to get an old place, find your get your place and get away from, okay, get away, get, no longer have to get your own place, you not have to worry about staff all the time. Second thing, I like to be called out community, nobody's bothering me, just get out of the house.
So there are some things you like about living at 3801, obviously. You lived there happily for 25 years, but what is it that, you just said that there are some things that bother you about living with seven other people.
Because it's, you know, things that we could do together, husband, but husband, wife, new life things. With roommate, it's kind of just so too, not privacy, because you want to do something in our own place, we want to get our own place, do some things, not be screwing really tight things, and it's kind of, it's not privacy, because we want our privacy, it's our own place, we have our friends, and the second thing, I like to live in there, but we have to learn how to get our skills better. Learn how to go to the doctor's appointment by ourselves. Second thing, work our skill with our, we're living here now, and then working and getting a kind of job that we like. And this is important for me and my husband to live in our own place, not stay in a group apartment long enough.
So those are some of the things you'd like in your own place.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that you wanted to share with the committee of, before you stop today?
Well, I'm just happy, joyful, good energy. I like my job quotes. I like working in different places. Find my own place, do kind of different things, and go out commute by ourselves.
So having a place where you have some support, but that you don't have staff 24/7 and you don't have roommates is really important to you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So as you heard from Patsy, and thank you for being willing to share that. As you heard from
thank
Patsy,
you, Patsy. We're very glad you came to the committee today. We appreciate your time and coming today. Miss Manwaren.
As you heard from Patsy, she wants more independent housing. And Patsy's direct support staff, employees of Living Well Disability Services, are working together with Patsy and with Mike to help explore potential housing options. And we're also helping her to learn the skills that will help them succeed, such as more about public transportation, financial planning, future planning, and coordinating supports with community employment. Our transition specialist is supporting Patsy and Mike's family, her case manager, and her guardians to move alongside and support Patsy and Mike through this transition. And often it's the families who are really happy with the housing. For your family's been really happy with your housing. Well, Patsy may have been feeling like she could use more independence. That work is accelerated as a result of our short-term state PIP grant that we received that funded our transition specialist. And this is a service that could be sustained using some of the funding from this incentive from the ACO model once the PIP grant ends. National and state trends driven by increased expectations of people who have been increasingly integrated, federal and state legal challenges to the current system, and the potential unsustainability of funding for long-term care are all creating the need to rethink how Medicaid resources are applied. In Patsy's situation, the cost of her current residential services in an ICF on an annualized basis is approximately $69,100. That excludes transportation and housing expenses because those will need to go with wherever Patsy goes. She'll need housing and she'll need food. And Mike's services cost approximately the same amount. So reducing her staffing to approximately 20 to 30 hours a week, which is about what we anticipate they will need when they move to individual housing, would result in an anticipated annualized saving of approximately $20,000 per year, which in this case could be doubled to approximately $40,000 because both Mike and Patsy could receive supports together. Long-term savings can be better put to use supporting another person who really needs 24/7 supports. And we serve a lot of people who are going to need 24/7 supports long into their future. So sharing incentives with providers like Living Well Disability Services will allow us to serve both those people who require intensive residential services and those who anticipate moving into less intensive settings. As we redesign the service system, we need to match the right level of care with the needs of each person at the right time. Thank you so much for your time and attention. We urge your support and are happy to try and answer any questions that you have at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Manwarren and Ms. Johnson. Are there any questions for the testifiers? No questions. Is there anyone from the, Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just still trying to fully understand the model. I had a chance on Friday to meet with some people who are involved in it. But I'm wondering, Ms. Lynn had originally testified, and so did Scott, and they did a great job of kind of explaining the current service system and how it's moving people along, which is what we expect. We all try and make our lives move along, and our service system currently does that. But it wasn't clear to me how if they had gotten a $10,000 additional amount, what that would have done to change Scott's life, or how it was his success has been enabled without that additional funding. And so I'm just trying to understand what the gaps that we're filling. I understand that you're working right now with Patsy and Mike to try and move along, which is what we expect. But I just want to make sure that I understand the additional financing and how that amount was arrived at. And it seems like the story of Scott is actually probably more applicable because it's actually been achieved in terms of getting him increasingly independent.
Well, Ms. Manwarren.
I can speak to the housing side of service equation, and then I think Judy Lisney would be happy to speak to more to Scott's perspective. Prior to coming to work for Living Well Disability Services, I worked for a housing organization that was helping people to move into permanent and supported housing from homelessness. And it's remarkable how much our funding for an ICF or for a waivered home is prescribed in terms of what services are provided, what compliance needs to be achieved through a result of the limited staff resources that we have. And those hours of service are all currently dedicated to providing those required supports for people who are living in a group home setting. There isn't a lot of margin for taking somebody to visit apartments, and their skill set isn't focused on talking with landlords or negotiating a lease or those kinds of things that really are required in that move from moving from a group home setting into an independent living setting in the community. And that's where these resources could be applied in our setting in terms of helping this transition specialist who all she's doing is working with case managers who we have very supportive. Patsy has a very supportive case manager in Hennepin County, but she has a huge caseload and her time isn't spent in taking Patsy to look at various housing settings that might be appropriate for she and Mike. And her time is not going to be able to be freed up to negotiate a lease with a landlord who, for somebody who doesn't have any lease history, Patsy's never held a lease, so there's going to be reticence on behalf of a landlord to sign a lease with somebody who isn't even her own guardian at this point. We've been working for several years with Patsy's family to help them, and with the case manager, frankly, to help them to envision a different future for Patsy that's more aligned with what she would like to have in her future, because in the past, as this system developed, safety's been a priority, and risk management has been a priority, and those are still important, but in order to be able to achieve some of Patsy's goals, we have to apply resources differently, and that's where these incentive payments can really help us to maintain employees who can focus on those conversations and on this goal and to making that happen.
Thank you, Ms. Van Worm. Ms. Lisney, can you come up and just very briefly address the second half of that question?
Yeah, and I would just say the same thing, that the current funding that we get is for the ongoing services, and this would help fund that upfront cost that currently isn't funded. So it's a goal LifeWorks has to move people to less dependency, but getting really focused on it, we think an incentive payment rather than a 15-minute unit type payment where you're supposed to be 15-minute units with the client would help us scale it up.
Thank you, Ms. Lisney. Representative Lobler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we're all just still learning, and that's the service system. I know we've had ARC has been funded by Minnesota. I think they have like 1,200 people that they have moved into housing successfully, and they've actually specialized in that as opposed to each individual provider trying to develop its own relationship with landlords, its own curriculum, its own efforts. And so, you know, this would be a different model as opposed to working with that specialized service that works, you know, across settings, across various providers.
And actually, we are coordinating with
Ms. Manworn.
Oh, I'm sorry. We are coordinating with those resources in the community. It's just helping to make the link between Patsy and Housing Link, or Patsy and the ARC of Minnesota, or Patsy and PACER services. So it is both. We need both.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify? Welcome. Please make your way to the testifier's table, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Hi, I'm Mark Hughes, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me this little bit of time today. I'm a former member of the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities. And
current TV star.
Thank you, you're very kind. This HF 973 here is a bill of an age-old thing that the disability community has really been trying to accomplish: inclusion in the community, housing, education, and employment. It's a new angle we have to accomplish this goal, we believe. The Olmsted Plan is something that's been worked on the last few years now. I know the Minnesota State Council has been very supportive of it. While you have the right to hold it over and ask questions, I'm asking please not to hold up the bill and keep this bill moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes, for your testimony. With that, any other questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zerwas, in regards to the Olmsted Plan, which I think a lot of this is modeled after, I'm recalling the diagram in which the Olmsted Plan showed us of the integration, you know, transportation, healthcare, employment, and then at the top of that chart was community integration, community involvement, and just what in your bill does specifically get those folks actively involved in the community, and I don't mean work or employment, but actively involved in becoming part of the community. I have a bill also that's coming, I think, down the line perhaps, that helps identify and train people to help the people get involved in the community. You know, be active in their schools and their churches and their nonprofit groups.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald. No, I think that's an excellent point. I think giving people autonomous housing or giving people a job, and the community does not reach the goals of the Olmsted plan and the Olmsted decision. So I think the important thing about the collaboration occurring under the Altair Cooperative is that each individual client will have their unique situation assessed and find a setting that's most appropriate for them, and then set up a plan and a system to help them fully integrate in a housing location that has suitable transportation environment, in a work situation that accommodates their condition and their situation in life, and an engagement within the community that makes them the most of what they want to be. As we heard from Patty, who talked about wanting independent housing and more freedom. We talked about this idea of when you have a caseworker, you know, that won't be one-on-one, that's going to be billing per 15-minute units versus developing this upfront plan for this comprehensive community integration. I think that's one of the metrics that this will be based on and studied on, and I think that's what one of the things that makes this project so unique compared to what we've seen before. If you have something.
Yes, I guess I'd say that work also helps you be more included in the community. I know that Scott gets to go to ball games and can use the transportation to get around town because he lives downtown, and some of his buddies have moved downtown too. We have people that can go to the events and so on. So becoming more included in the community, part of that is having money in your pocket to do stuff with. And of course, that's part of the overall person-centered plan that would be developed. And we think work is one of the best ways to get included. Not everyone's going to work, and there's many other ways to become included as well.
Thank you, Ms. Listney. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we all share the goals of people living as independently and in as integrated a settings as possible and working. We haven't done, I will just say, in the past as good as I think we're going to do in the future, which is why we have the federal courts breathing down our necks about our 5,000-person waiting list, as well as whether or not we're doing adequately for the people we serve. This only would serve, as you described it, 200 people. And the system is really doing what we're describing and been discussing for people throughout the whole state of Minnesota, whether they're served by these seven providers or the hundreds of others throughout the state of Minnesota. And so it's still, you know, we do need partnerships with providers, but we do need to have, you know, sort of the best ideas come forward. And this isn't a competitive process. It sets aside a fairly major chunk of funding for 200 individuals while we still have 5,000 people almost on the waiting list to get services. And I know that in the governor's budget there's some money, but it actually serves twice as many people with a dramatically less amount of money in a competitive process. And so I think we have some competing models here that we have one group of providers that has a bill in front of us that they've been working on, and I assume that they will primarily refer people within their network. And then we have, you know, all the other hundreds of providers in every one of our communities who are also doing the same work. And I think we're just going to have to kind of figure out as we go forward and wrestle, hopefully, in the policy committee with this about what is our best strategy. Because just to serve those people on the waiting list, the DHS report that came out in December is $75 million. If we were to provide $10,000 every time somebody's life becomes more independent, just for you know, half of them, we would be talking, of the people served, we'd probably be talking about $250 million. And people's lives aren't static. They're going to change and change and change. They may start, like our witness, in an ICFMR, a larger facility, and then move to something less, maybe semi-independent living. They may, like most of us, they're going to change careers 3-4 times. And if we're paying $10,000 with every change, it's going to, I'm concerned that it's not a sustainable model. And I think we all have to wrestle with that, because I'm haunted by the people who aren't getting served. and how do we most efficiently use the dollars that we have? And so I'm really interested in hearing not only this proposal, but whatever, we haven't seen the detail yet on the administration proposal. And I think we need the innovation of our providers. But I do hope that we have a more comprehensive discussion, and we hear from other providers, not just those who are in this consortium, about whether this model would work for them.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, I think there's someone from DHS in the audience that maybe could shed some light. I know this collaboration has been working, I think, for over a year.
Yes, Representative Zerwas, Ms. Hamilton is in the audience. If she could come down and briefly address that, we would appreciate it. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hamilton. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. Just to clarify, is the question what is the difference between the governor's proposal and this proposal, or what is the?
Ms. Hamilton, I think that would probably be a good clarifying discussion, just to some of the differences between the proposals and what we might see from the governor.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The governor's proposal and this bill have very similar goals to help people be more integrated in the community, to live in the community, and to have competitive integrated employment. The governor's proposal is an RFP process so that different providers could apply and then be selected by the Department of Human Services. And we ramp up to serving about 600 people. And the funding starts at $1.3 million in the first year and goes up to $2.4 million, and that would be what it would stay at, is $2.4 million ongoing.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Appreciate that. Members, we do have an amendment in the packet that is Amendment A1. That is Representative Loeffler's. I'm going to ask that you may withdraw that, since we are re-referring to the Committee on Policy, and maybe have an opportunity to work on that between now and then. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad to did not offer it, since it has. I don't have to withdraw it. I don't have to offer it. But the reason I put that together, and I did appreciate the chance meeting with some representatives from Altair last week, and I had put in calls to DHS and some advocates and some county representatives, and there was a lot of confusion about this particular bill. And so I wanted to at least start raising some key issues that I think we can ponder as it goes to the policy committee and then potentially comes back here. And one of them is a key issue about whether or not this is a test of a new vision, and we ought to have a pilot and a control group so we can actually see, does this make a difference? Does it move faster than the ordinary way of doing things? Is this the right amount of money? You know, what are the outcomes? It was seemed to be a little bit light on that. And I think there was some confusion about what responsibilities would remain with the county case manager, which we have in law as sort of the quality assurance and oversight versus the proposed model for some life planning. So I'm glad to hear that we're going to deal with that in the policy committee. So we have a more full discussion, because I think these things are, I mean, it's, we have responsibility for the total life of individuals. The people who testified, you know, their ability to move on, to achieve their dreams, to meet their basic needs, to have a more flexible life is totally dependent upon the system, listening to them and moving them on. And I think we really have to take responsibility for just weighing all the different alternatives. And this came from one group of providers. I'd love to hear, you know, who else is thinking about ideas as well.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Zerwas, any other discussion? Any other closing comments, Representative Zerwas?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, members, what interests me about this ACO project was the idea of having comprehensive services as a part of the implementation of the Homestead Plan, while finding some potential cost savings through evaluating metrics within implementation of this program. I think we need to find a way to get as many people in the most appropriate setting as possible, but we need to find a way to do that in a very individualized way. And sometimes implementing a program in a very individualized way, it incurs some upfront costs. But if we're planful and we're mindful and we do something well planned out and upfront, understanding that's going to be expensive, but we implement the right solution for that population and for that individual, I think that's when we reap the cost savings benefits. And so that's why I think this pilot project is a worthy project to invest in and a worthy project to investigate further. I look forward to a very comprehensive discussion in health policy.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I'm sure Representative Loeffler can iron out some stuff in between here and there. And with that, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 973 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Next up, we have House File 974. Representative McDonald. Welcome to the committee, Representative McDonald. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 974 be laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
Representative McDonald moves that House File 974 be moved over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. We now have the bill before us. No amendments from you, Representative McDonald. Please proceed your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I want to lay out the problem that we have and then a solution, and then introduce my guest and testifiers, and they'll go through a little bit more in detail. The problem is that we have an approximately over 5,300 pregnant women in Minnesota that expose their babies to alcohol and put them at risk of the fetal alcohol syndrome. That's a big problem. From 2000 to 2010, 5% of all female substance abusers abused treatment admissions were pregnant. Because we can change this reality in doing so and improve the lives of thousands of children, we, in this particular bill, will protect the most vulnerable, those babies who are still in their mother's wombs. And that is why I'm putting forth this bill. This bill does spend $2 million each year to support effective local partnerships and local communities and local community organizations with a direct focus on helping at-risk mothers to stay clean during their pregnancy. I have with me Mrs. Susan Carlson, who will also testify and give you a little bit more data on my bill. So, Mr. Chairman, I turn it over to Mrs. Carlson.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Ms. Carlson, welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Susan Carlson, and I am former First Lady, former Hennepin County District Court Judicial Officer, and founder and president of the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. Before I start my testimony, the lawyer in me wanted to suggest a friendly author's amendment to the bill so we have the correct terminology. And it would be on line, in section C, line 1.19, delete syndrome and insert spectrum. The correct terminology is fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
Ms. Carlton, Carlson, could you please state the line number, page and line number again, and what you're proposing?
1.8.
It's in section C, which is on line, and it would be line 1.19, and you would delete syndrome in the first word and insert spectrum. Okay. Thank you. That would be the correct terminology.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Ms. Aves, I think Representative McDonald will move that technical correction. If Ms. Aves could just restate that for me, please, to make sure that we've got that correctly.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be on page 1, line 19, delete syndrome and insert spectrum.
And Representative Liebling points out that the same is on line point 1.3 in the title. Would that also be the intention for the author?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And Ms. Aves, could you please restate that to make sure that we have that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, this amendment would be on page 1, line 3, delete the word syndrome and insert spectrum.
1.8.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that that actually is, if we say fetal alcohol spectrum disorders on line 1.3, and delete syndrome and related effects.
Ms. Daves?
Mr. Chair, this is the title of the bill, and we can instruct the reviser to make changes to the title and just give the reviser the general instruction.
Can we so would that be the motion from the author to just make the general change to the reviser to
amend
change that throughout the
Mr. Chair, the instruction would be to the reviser to amend the title accordingly. My question to Ms. Carlson would be, is the title, is the name of the organization Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of committee and Chief Author McDonald. It's always a delight to be back at the legislature and the state capitol to speak about an issue that's near and dear to my heart, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And to speak in favor of a bill, House File 974, which will reduce the incidence of this disability, this 100% preventable disability, which is the leading known preventable cause of mental retardation. Sarah Messalt, Executive Director of MOFAS, is also here to answer any questions with regard to the administration of the grant. And we also have two moms who have traveled from Olmsted County to share with you their stories and how a pilot program in Olmsted County has helped them in their struggles with addiction and to become productive moms and members of our community. I don't know if you know how I became involved, but I became involved with this issue when I was First Lady and also serving as Hennepin County District Court Juvenile Court referee. And it was there that I saw the reality of the devastation of substance abuse in our systems. And I learned how this substance abuse affects so many children before they're even born, and that it is 100% preventable. I also learned that that early identification and just identification of the disability helps caregivers, and we have an audience that are here that are caregivers, and I thank them for doing that. And others understand that the brain deficits will prevent what we call secondary disabilities, which are failing and dropping out of school, getting into trouble with the law, mental health issues, and it goes on and on. I'm sure you've heard the saying, Minnesota is the land of 10,000 lakes and 10,000 treatment centers. But seriously, we do love our alcohol, and an estimated 23% of our women in childbearing years binge drink. And binge drinking, one episode, could cause fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. It permeates our various systems, and that's where I saw it, and in particular, the child protection area. We know that alcohol is the most common drug of choice and that most women who use drugs also use alcohol. And I know I had a conversation with the Commissioner of Human Services yesterday, and I know that you're going to be getting some testimony on the opiate drug use. I do have a chart that will show you that the research, and I can pass it around, it's a little blurry, but it shows that alcohol, the consensus on the research on alcohol, that it has strong effects on short-term and long-term. And there isn't any consensus yet on a lot of the other drugs, including opiates. The Minnesota Supreme Court, alcohol and drug and other drugs, found that approximately 75% of the child protection cases had alcohol and drug as an underlying factor. So it's in our child protection system. It has a profound impact on our society and our state, and it affects, I've heard so many stories of families. Each year, an estimated 5,367 babies are estimated to be born who have been prenatally exposed. The incidence, nationwide incidence, is now 4 out of 100 in the United States. It causes permanent brain damage, physical defects, facial and heart-lung defects, and the number one cause of preventable development disability. And the human cost, obviously, is devastating. The financial impact is huge. We have a parent who works closely with MOFAS who kept track of how much money her adopted daughter cost the county and state, and she reports that the cost of services for her daughter, who is now 20, reached $1.7 million. And the Center for Disease Control estimates that the lifetime cost to society for publicly supported programs with a person with FASD is $2.5 million. And I know when we did the Governor's Task Force back in 1997, we had one county, and I can share you the memo, in Minnesota, that it was two families in one county that was costing that county $2.6 million. So, obviously, preventing this is the key. And preventing prenatal exposure from high-risk, chemically-dependent mothers is extremely difficult, but absolutely essential. And one of the things that I've learned, if you can identify a woman who gives birth to one child with FASD, they are 70% likely to give birth to another child with FASD. So if you don't identify the children, the women become the biomarkers. And I had, in juvenile court, I had many times where I would see a woman who had given birth to 7 or 8 children with FASD. And so it became generational. You could see the same effects happening the families. So, House File 974 goes to the very heart of this problem, and it looks at the multiple complex needs of these women who are struggling with addiction. And it provides a way for them to receive the support and services that they need, rather than just having a chemical dependency program. It helps them become very productive, and you'll hear from a couple of moms. And a program like CRAFT in Olmsted does provide a safe and effective way to support healthy pregnancy outcomes and eliminate a lot of those costs. It also replicates a successful national program called PCAP, and that was what I originally saw when I was First Lady. And that has received kind of the seal of approval from SAMHSA through it's called the Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices. And it is extremely cost-effective, costing about $3,700 per mom per year. And so, again, the programs that are given the right support and having a healthy baby and preventing that child can be a reality. And it is working. Last report from Olmsted reported that all 44 mothers who were in the program had negative toxicology screens. That's huge. With an addictive population, that's huge. They are living alcohol and drug-free. And you do also have a letter from me in the packet, and that gives the data on the Washington State PCAP outcomes. And Representative McDonald talked about the $2 million per year, which would go to the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, which I currently serve as president. They have been managing the FASD state's money since 2004, and they have a proven track record of effective grants management and maximizing the state funds with private and community resources, foundation resources. It's an extremely good model, and I would highly recommend it in other areas. It's become the state's go-to agency as well as a national model. And I would assure you that the grant funds would be successfully implemented. So I urge you to support the program. And now I have the honor of introducing two brave moms who have experienced this program firsthand and care so much that they that this program be available beyond Olmsted County. First is Katie Seaver. She's an alumnus of the program, and then we'll have Eileen Hendrickson, who's a current participant of the CRAFT program.
Welcome, Katie and Eileen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Ms. Seaver and Ms. Hendrickson, please proceed up, and if you could state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Katie Seaver.
Oh, Eileen Hendrickson.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Seaver, please proceed with your testimony.
All right, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Katie Seaver. I have unfortunately got my third DUI and first and only drug felony possession in September of 2012. Shortly after that, I became pregnant. And then I started going to the CRAFT program in April of 2013 because I was recommended to it by my drug treatment counselor at Empower CTC. I was lost and unsure on where to turn and where to go. The CRAFT program helped me by being there for me, guiding me in my goals, offering many resources that were available. Without them, I truly do not know where I would be today. I gained confidence in becoming the person I was meant to be. They gave me rides to all of my treatment groups, medical appointments, and other imperative places for my recovery. On a monthly basis, they provided much needed support, as in one-on-one meetings with case managers and with the child educator in the home, and sober social events without kids, and supplied gas cards, bus passes, diapers, wipes, and donated clothing and supplies that were needed. While going to group two times a week, I had the support I needed to go through my struggles, to get through my struggles and accomplishments that no other place could give me. While my kids got the attention on their well-being that they needed with a child educator. My second lovely daughter, Emilia, was born substance-free 3 days before my one-year sobriety date, so we share a birthday in a way. Thanks to the help of all the women involved in CRAFT, I truly hope and wish for other mothers that are struggling, who want and need the help and guidance that this program has to offer, can receive it regardless of their location. I am currently an alumni with 2 years of sobriety and completed all my legal obligations and very, very close to getting my driving privileges back. And I am also almost all of my government assistance I don't need. I am self-supported, minus medical assistance for my kids. But thank you very much for this opportunity to share for this program.
Thank you for your testimony. And Ms. Hendrickson.
Hi, thank you, members of the committee. My name's Eileen Hendrickson. I have two daughters, Gwendolyn, who's 3, and Genevieve, who's 11 months. I began the program in November of 2013, and Genevieve was born into the program substance-free. They helped me. I have 45 days sober now. They've helped me gain the resources that I needed to work towards becoming are getting outpatient treatment. I truly believe that if it was not for this program, that I wouldn't have gotten back involved in meetings, because meetings are a great resource, but it seems like the CRAFT program has so much more than just the support that I need. I feel like it would be devastating to lose this program because of how much they've helped me be able to express myself and help with my confidence and the relationships I've gained with the other women. My daughters have also, too, grown through this program and been able to thrive in a safe, positive environment and play with the other children. I've also learned how to take care and teach my children in a healthy manner due to the staff and the speakers that we've heard at the program. I personally live 40 miles away from Rochester right now, so I do have a vehicle, which is thankful that I'm able to drive there, but I have numerous friends that I've talked to that don't have transportation that have heard of this program and would love to get involved. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, ladies, for your testimony, and congratulations, and all the best with your recovery in the days ahead. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to comment that I carried the bill in the last term for the CRAFT program, and I thank you, Representative McDonald, for carrying this. I think that this is such an important investment to make. The testimony was impressive about the human cost, about the financial cost, and I just think that these kinds of investments, if we make them in our youngest, very youngest, they come back to us manyfold. And so thank you. I really encourage members to, I hope we can get this into the omnibus bill and get it passed, because I think this is just one of the best things we could do. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative McDonald, we do have one more testifier. Christy LaForest is here to testify. From St. Louis County, Mr. De La Forest, please.
Go ahead.
Proceed. Welcome to the committee, Mr. De La Forest.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, good afternoon. For the record, Chris De La Forest, and I briefly wanted to testify on behalf of St. Louis County. You have a letter in your packet from Commissioner Patrick Boyle, and he is deeply disappointed he couldn't be here today to testify. St. Louis County has a very successful program called Superior Babies in this regard, and the county board had asked to make sure that they are on the record today being very, very supportive and very thankful to Representative McDonald for his authorship, and certainly the county is available to act as a resource in this regard. They've been a leader in many respects in this important program. As I mentioned, Commissioner Boyle and the rest of the board wanted to make sure that you as committee members knew how much they value this program and how supportive they are, and hopeful that this legislation will be included, Mr. Chairman, in your omnibus bill. With that, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. De La Forest. Appreciate it. Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you for giving me a hearing on this very important legislation. It's actually a twofer. It's a two-for-one. As you've witnessed, not only do we help the babies, the most precious cargo that I think we can all agree on, but we also help the mothers transform their lives. You just heard testimony that they're new women. They're committed to their babies, to their children, and to a better life. So this legislation, much like others, is very important. It pinpoints, it's very laser-focused at one area, ensuring that mothers don't drink while they're having babies, while the babies are percolating, if you will, for lack of a better word.
I don't believe that's a legislative term.
Is there a reset button here?
We all wish there were.
And then also in the bill you'll notice, Representative Hamilton has given me the hook. I'll take that cane any day. That's a great one. But also on the back of the bill you'll notice that it asks for results, specific results, that they report back to the department on the success rates. So it's under scrutiny. And I encourage the chair and the rest of the members to encourage the chair to make sure that this makes it into the omnibus bill so we can protect the precious cargo of our babies.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Thank you, Ms. Carlson, and all the advocates who are here today on behalf of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to interrupt you, but I have one small request. We have a little young man here who would like to just say a couple words.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anytime.
Oops.
Welcome to the committee, young man. What is your name?
Peter.
Peter, welcome to the committee. You have a last name, Peter?
Lorenz. Peter Lorenz.
Welcome, Peter. And go ahead with your testimony, Peter.
Okay. Hi, I'm Peter. I have FASD. I am 9 years old. I am in third grade. I have been to 5 schools before. I am homeschooled this year. I love to hunt, fish, and camp. Life is really hard and hard. I have a hard time at school. I don't like school because the teachers do not know my needs. They would have me go in the timeout room. It is a small room. They would lock me, the doors on me. I am asking for you to help us educate the community. This invisible disease, but I am not invisible. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Very nice job. Thanks for coming to the committee today, and thank you for interrupting for that, Ms. Carlson. I'm glad you did.
I knew you would appreciate it, Ms. Carlson.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Peter. You did a nice job. You're very brave. Did a much better job than Representative McDonald. So with that, we're going to finish up. We can... is there anyone else who would like to testify on behalf of House File 974? Any other questions from committee members? We just got one piece of work to do. Representative McDonald is going to move the following oral amendment, line 1.19, delete syndrome and insert spectrum. I'm sorry,
Mr. Chairman. They're trying to get your attention in the back row there.
Oh, okay. We have another testifier. Thank you, Representative Hamilton.
My name is Kari Wiesner, and I have a son who has FASD, but I'm a birth mother to this child, and if there had been a program like CRAFT, ironically, 8 years ago, I gave birth to this daughter, and I went home, and I was given no counseling. I went home, too, with a bottle of pills, and I drank my depression away. If there had been a program like CRAFT, I think if I had gotten pregnant with my child, he would not have FASD. It would have saved hundreds of tax dollars a week, and I would have been in a much better position, and my son would be a healthier child.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we're just going to incorporate that from the earlier line 1.19, we'll delete syndrome and insert spectrum and insert the revisor to amend the title accordingly. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That is incorporated, and we will hold this over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. And with that, members, we are adjourned.